So the artist is Vitamin Swing, is that it? Vitamin Swing, and the album is Swinging to Sting and the Police. That's great. That's the bumper music we'll be hearing today. Hey, good morning. Welcome to the program. Welcome to the roundtable panel. It's very nice to have you with us and to have your participation in the program. You're a vital part of what we do here, as you well know, and it is very nice that you're spending at least part of your day with us. What would we do without you? Well, what would we do without our panelists? Let me introduce you to them, and we will get started and talk about what's happening in this world of ours. Let me begin by welcoming Teresa Bourgeois. She was with us yesterday. She's with us today. We couldn't be more thrilled. Good morning.
Good morning. How delighted to be here.
It's a day. It'd be an okay day, right?
Yeah.
It'll be all right. Vera Carias-Kelly is here. She is a political science professor at Siena College. She studies comparative politics. We're going to be talking about a lot of world stories today, so we look forward to tapping into your great expertise.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for being with us. Alan is, I think, playing Candy Crush. What are you doing?
I was playing Candy what?
Candy Crush.
What is that?
It's a game
really?
On your computer, and I was, yeah.
I see.
Yeah. You know,
I can wake up all night long with Roselle next to me, and she's always playing something Words with Friends.
Oh, yeah.
And she keeps five games going at once.
Well, that's good. That means you have friends. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember I was interviewing Itzhak Perlman.
Ooh.
And Itzhak Perlman was talking about, I said, how do you get ready to go? You know, even though you've played a particular piece 8,000 times, what is it like when you walk out on that stage? And he said, right before, I just sit down with my phone and I play Candy Crush.
Interesting.
Well, there you go. That's interesting. So he said it completely takes away your mind from everything. But there's something mechanical to it as well. And then he puts the phone down, goes out, and just wows the crowd. I thought, well, that's cool. That's very,
amazing.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, guess who else is with us? We have Rosemary Armeo, our panelist from afar. She is an Amman Jordan. She joins us this morning.
No, actually, I'm not an Amman Jordan.
Oh, where the hell are you?
I'm in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Wow.
Now,
great.
Now, okay, so yesterday on the program, we talked to David K. Johnston on the show.
Yep, he's there too.
And he said, he said he was at this conference, and when he mentioned that, I wondered if you also were going to be in attendance.
Indeed, there is, if I ever went on here, God forbid, and I'm thinking about this, the entire reporting power of the world would go out tomorrow. There are 1,200 investigative reporters from 130 countries here. It's the once every other year conference of the Global Investigative Journalist Network. And it's the first time they've held it in Africa, and it's pretty amazing. I'm looking out at the scene now as I'm speaking to you.
Now,
journalists from everywhere.
What we talked to David about yesterday is he said that, now, of course, this is his beat, but he was saying that every single reporter from around the world was coming up to him in the hotel lobby when he was out walking in the coffee shops and was just saying, what the hell is going on in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be that they'd have a panel, as they do in about a half an hour here, on covering repressive regimes. And the United States is part of that now, covering autocrats. That's what David K. Johnston was speaking about, because we've got one now. And I'm sorry to Trump lovers, but he definitely has the same patterns and behaviors and admiration for others of that ilk. And it's pretty amazing. We are learning, we American journalists are learning how to cover governments that are in that situation from our African and Asian colleagues. Pretty amazing.
So are we getting, you sound pretty good now, so you'll be able to sit in one place and hear us okay, and that'll be all right?
Put another way, Rosemary,
Hi, Alan.
Hi, sweetie. In the beginning, I take that back. In the beginning, you were diffuse. Your voice was diffuse, but now it's much clearer. So whatever you're doing now, do it.
Whatever I'm doing now, keep it up. Okay.
Yeah.
I will do that. Well, Now, tell me, am I wrong on the time? I thought this was just about the right time. Am I off by an hour or something?
No.
No. No, we're starting the show. We started the show with you. You're on with Teresa Bourgeois. You're on with Vera Carias-Kelly. You're on with Alan Chartok. And you're on with the Great Northeast.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Okay. Well, good morning, and we'll check in and see how all this goes as far as our signal, and we'll just cross our fingers it all goes well. Now, let us go to what is happening in the world, and we would love, of course, to hear from you. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, to be a part of our program, and we do love having you be a part. Now, let us go to, we'll start with the, do you want to start with Zimbabwe since you were there? And I don't know how much longer we'll have you for.
Okay.
So what is the situation? What do you know about this? Because my understanding is that, Robert Mugabe is under house arrest as rule over Zimbabwe teeters. That is the headline. And so how were you impacted by this and are looking at this story from your vantage point?
Well, I've been personally impacted because on Sunday I'm supposed to be flying to Victoria Falls. And so we are monitoring the situation. They're not shooting at planes or anything like that. But you have to report early to the airport from South Africa, which is next door, to fly in because they don't know what the situation will be. It is big news in South Africa. Because, the president here is in charge of the regional affiliation of states, and so it really falls to him to keep peace and stability in the area. So while Robert Mugabe is a horrible dictator, and it's good in a way that he's maybe been pushed out, it looks like increasingly like he has been, there's great worry about what comes next, because he never designated an heir, except he seemed to be leaning towards his miserable wife, Grace, and that may have been what kicked off the military's actions about to boost him out of office after 36 years. So it's very precarious here. It's front page giant news in all of South Africa, and it's what everybody's talking about here.
93 years old, and the question being, what's next? Vera, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, Rosemary, now that we have you on, I had read some accounts that the Vice President Mangawe is currently working very closely with the military leadership in Zimbabwe on trying to stabilize the situation, of course, making sure that Grace Mugabe does not and her young sort of insurgent supporters don't assail the Mugabe the elders. And so they're holding the Harare under control, and they're waiting to figure out who might be the transition government. Is that right?
It's really interesting. The military has this high regard for the liberation heroes. Mugabe, of course, is one of them, and so is the vice president that you mentioned. He's key to this. And it was Mugabe's actions, firing the vice president, who's been his lieutenant for years, for more than the time he's been in office. And he's no saint either. Let's not make a mistake about that. He used to be head of the intelligence services, and he's kind of a monster too, but he's well respected by the military because of his liberation history. So Grace wants control and gets her husband. She probably has been running the government for some time because he's 93 and is increasingly slow. You know, he's just slowed down. And so she gets rid of him, and that's when the military stepped in. And they're doing two things. One is they don't want to put the vice president in as a de facto president yet. They want him to run a caretaker government until there are elections in the spring. Because, and that's another thing that's really, really important in the South Africa area, they want democratically elected governments. They do not want coups. This is really bad. And the other thing they want to do is give dignity to Mugabe, despite the fact that he's ruined the state and run it like his own fiefdom, and he really does not deserve anything but our contempt, especially the contempt of his citizens. they want him treated with respect, and so they're negotiating a settlement with him.
Hmm. Well, now, Rosemary, what occurs to us as we listen to the BBC, I know it does with me, is it one corruption group after another? They mentioned this morning that the guy who was in charge of all their minerals and everything was their nephew. So that's extraordinary. But one gets the idea that corruption is so endemic that if it's not Mugabe, what about the other guys, who are taking over? Won't they be the same?
That's the problem. They will be the same. And you're right. Nepotism is horrible. It's like the head of minerals, which is a source of great, great wealth in Zimbabwe, is in the hands of the family. It's like putting, I don't know, your son-in-law in charge of state affairs.
Well, and yeah. Well, I wanted to mention, I was just talking to my students about the term kleptocracy, and Zimbabwe certainly fits into that category, right, where you have, instead of, a merit-based system, a system where, nepotism reigns, as well as your relatives get to be appointed to positions where they just fill their pockets and purchase properties in other countries. Yeah.
One wonders whether you couldn't really find, a friendly person without the same name or without being a direct relative who could do the same thing without offending people the way that they do by putting all of their people, their relatives, into these offices. Hey, the same thing goes on in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Rosemary, you probably also remember, I don't know when exactly that was in Zimbabwe, where Mugabe announced he was going to take farmland away from, white landholders. Yeah, and he promised to redistribute that money to poor black farmers, correct? And then instead, his relatives got the land, and it never was used for actual farming, as far as I recall.
That's totally true. In the country, which is potentially so rich and had a very promising economy, is now importing food and is quite dependent. It's impoverished, and it's because the state has been systematically stripped of resources by Mugabe and his friends and family. Nothing unique about that in Africa. I saw the same thing in Uganda, where you have Museveni has been also a liberation leader. He's been in power for decades now, and he enriches his tribe, his people. They have all the great jobs. They have all the entree. They get state resources are sold off, and the money goes to his tribe, to his people.
Now, the BBC...
So it's a shame.
The BBC made a couple of interesting points this morning as I was listening very early in the morning. The first was that it's, by African standards, it's a quite a wealthy country, number one. Number two, there's a huge educational establishment, and as a result... Pardon me. Many of the people who with advanced degrees are leaving the country and going to places like South Africa because...
South Africa has been a big, you're right, it's been a big beneficiary of the trouble in Zimbabwe. There's a brain drain from one country into the next.
I was going to say, not only the brain drain that happens, but also poor farmers have left Zimbabwe for neighboring countries, and especially South Africa, in terms of, because they're so desperate to get jobs. And that has also been a problem for South Africa, which, of course, has a large stake in stabilizing a neighboring country.
The cities in South Africa and throughout southern Africa have been, they're overwhelmed by hordes of people coming in from rural areas for that exact reason. They're looking for any sort of job. They live in terrible conditions. Mm-hmm. And I just went to Soweto yesterday and took pictures of people who are living in basically tin cans. I mean, they're like shacks made out of tin, no lights, no bathrooms. And I took the pictures of this because it reminds me of why we write about corruption. That's the cost of corruption. Money that's going to the Mugabes of the world is not being spent on the health and welfare of the citizens of these countries.
But the reason he does have a base of respect is because of what he did in 79, right, which is drive out the colonial rule. But what also interests me about the region is the powerful role that China has played as they become a weakened state. China has come in. And they're the largest investor there. They have provided military assistance. They build hospitals. They're building a lot of the power infrastructure of the country. Right. Yes. And so
not just the country, the whole continent. Whole continent is Chinese influence now, because they came in at a time when the United States was insisting on stupid things like adherence to human rights. And they just came in and said, we don't care what you do to your people. We just want your minerals. And China has infused money and taken out lots of resources and wields enormous respect. There are several sessions in this journalistic conference I'm on about the influence of China in Africa.
The when you look at the situation, I mean, we don't, obviously there's not going to be a quick fix, but I assume it's a very fluid situation and everybody's watching very closely.
Right.
Well, it's pretty clear that the military are nervous, you know, about how far they want to go with this, because they don't want a popular uprising. I doubt it that could happen, but the military is in a different situation.
I mean, it's interesting because it's a coup, although inside the country it's not a coup, called a coup, because it's an unusual coup for that part of Africa. It's not a bloody coup. It's a coup where people are removed and there's a holding pattern.
Yes,
but it's strange.
But it's not a military takeover. It's a military stabilizing, as you say, right, Alan?
I'm not sure.
I believe it's a military stabilizing to...
Say again? Yeah,
they are calling it here a guardianship coup.
Right.
I love that expression.
Oh, yeah. Sure. But in the end, there's always going to be some...
The guardian of democracy.
Right. Which the Turks used when the military was in control, by the way.
And, by the way, the Turks were not all wrong in having that protection of secularism the way they did it.
Although we don't like to use the military for claiming that they're protecting democratic structures, I don't believe.
So we have to go to a break. But Rosemary, we're having trouble hearing you. So do you mind if we say goodbye to you?
No, I think that would be fine. Thank you for letting me be on.
I thank you very, very much. We heard all the good stuff.
Rosemary, we got a dozen letters already saying great to hear Rosemary's voice.
All right. We'll be back. Rosemary, we'll talk soon. Take care. Bye-bye. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Vera Akarios-Kelly, and Teresa Bourgeois. We were having some trouble. I know listeners were having some issues as well hearing Rosemary, so we ended that conversation. We love having Rosemary. She'll be back at her spot where she has a really good phone line, and we'll try to get her on early next week. And then I know in December she's planning a trip back here, so we'll have her in studio too. So for all the Rosemary fans, you can keep... stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let us go to some letters, and then we will move on to other topics that we have to discuss today.
Right, Joe. Teresa, says Stephen Hyde, each time Teresa says, this gets a little wonky, but my attention sharpens because I'm about to learn something about my government I need to know. Wonk on, Teresa. Wonk on.
Wonk on. I don't.
I love it.
Yeah. That's
Thank you.
Yeah. That's one where you say thank you.
No, I'll take that.
Okay,
thank
good.
You. Thank
but,
you.
But a very good point, because when Teresa is on and we're having complicated discussions, every head eventually goes to Teresa because we don't know the answers, and you do.
Sometimes.
Okay. James says, good morning, panel. This may not be germane to today's subject, but I have a question for the... I'm sorry about this, folks. Brilliant Alan and fellow political scientist Vera. I'm just putting in your name. The Republicans in Congress are breaking so many conventions this year. One glaring exception seems to be the budget reconciliation process, the rule by which changes to law require 60 votes if they increase spending. My question is, why don't they just ignore this too? What happens from them crossing this line?
Well, you were talking about that yesterday.
Yeah.
Right, that they should... You mean, I don't think they should or will. I think that's a tradition because they know that right now they're in the leadership, but at another time they won't be. And they really need to adhere to those guidelines.
Well, you know, I think this idea about ignoring the norms as opposed to the law is very much on everybody's mind. They keep changing this stuff. I don't agree with you, I don't think, Teresa. I think if pressed and if it was the matter of getting this thing through or not, they would ignore this one, too, and they would change the rule. After all, this is just a rule that comes from the Congress itself.
But I think they're playing a different game here. So, for instance, they're saying that the personal tax cuts will sunset in 2025.
Right.
They don't believe that the personal tax cuts are going to sunset in 2025, but they need to have the math work. So they put that in the bill.
Exactly.
And then they know once you get to that point, they're not going to. And even that's what Congressman Faso essentially said, that a number of the other members of Congress basically said, well, we know that that's not what they really mean, so it's okay. Although he did announce last night he's not going to vote for the bill. But
which I find extraordinarily interesting. I mean,
he's
this
feeling
is a guy
pressure
who
from
tends
his constituents.
To hew to the Republican leadership. But in this case, he knows it's, you know, you don't do this. You're probably gone.
Right. So they're adhering back to the process question, though. So the Mitch McConnell, Senator McConnell, they're adhering to the letter of the process.
Yes.
But they're working around it by putting in phony numbers, essentially.
Yeah. Well, exactly right. Okay. David says, good morning, panel.
Good morning.
If the new tax plan for the rich and corporations, in quotes, passes, do the corporations still get all the loopholes? Thank you, David.
Many of them. That's one of the questions, that many of the loopholes they have chosen to close, you know, take away the tax deductions on the personal side, but not on the corporate side.
All right. Thank you very much for your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Move on to some other issues that we can talk about, and I would like to talk about the tax plan and the trouble that that now is in, with a Republican senator saying he will not back it. The news came out yesterday that Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, said that he will not, has raised major concerns. I think it's safe to call him a moderate, yes?
Yeah.
A GOP moderate raised concerns. The announcement cast doubt whether Republicans would be able to quickly pass what would be their first significant legislative achievement under President Trump.
You know, if you heard him, literally the words coming out of his mouth, he was angry. This guy was angry that they were passing it in this form. And he said, if they can do this without me, go ahead. But he sounded like he really had come out of negotiations the loser, and he was saying this.
And remember, he's from Wisconsin, and Speaker Ryan is from Wisconsin.
Right.
And so Speaker Ryan, you know, as we've been saying, his messaging on this bill is just not true. They repeat it a lot, but if you say something that's wrong over and over, it's still wrong. And Johnson called him on, not directly, but essentially
so,
called him on that yesterday.
And then he joined Senator, we were talking about Susan Collins yesterday. She has now said that she cannot support this legislation.
Well, no. Did she? I think the last I read, she said she has troubles with it, but she didn't say, she refused to say that she wouldn't vote for it. Mm. I mean, let's face it. You're Susan Johnson. You're up there in Maine.
Susan Collins.
Collins, I'm so sorry. Yeah, I didn't think they got married. Yeah, okay. So they're up there in Maine, and you're looking at your constituency. Do they want a tax cut? Yes, they want a tax cut. So you're sort of pushed into being supportive of the tax legislation, but when they added the poison pill of the health care, the same thing they've been trying to do unsuccessfully all along, I think she now has grounds to say no.
Yeah, I'm sorry. She just said they have erred when they changed their tax bill this week to include a repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which is what I have been against all along.
Did she say specifically, I won't vote for it?
Didn't she start like that as well on the prior health care bill?
She
started cautiously, mentioned these warnings, how her position is shifting in opposition. So I believe that she will probably vote against
it. And just remember, Maine just had an election, mm-hmm. and they voted against the governor for Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. You know, the people of Maine sent a strong signal that we care about health care and that we want a stable health care system that's available to as broad a group of constituents as possible. Mm-hmm. And so why would she then vote for a tax bill that's going to decimate the Affordable Care Act and deeply cut into Medicaid?
And you still have Corker and McCain, Senators Corker and McCain, who have been very silent and just say they have reservations.
Right. And their previous statements have based on what they've said in the past about exploding the deficit and about health care, one would think that this tax proposal is inconsistent with what they have talked about in the past.
And of course, McCain didn't say anything really until that famous night that he walked in there and just pointed his thumb down. Mm-hmm. So one would think that this may fall into the same way of doing things.
But what's interesting to me is you have people like, I listened to an interview with Congresswoman Claudia Tenney from New York, a Republican, yesterday, talking about how great this is going to be for middle and lower income people and how much it's going to help her state. You have a number of Republicans in New York and in California who clearly the House version, let's talk about the House version because Donald Trump is on the way to talk to the House folks now this morning, and that's scheduled for a vote today. Clearly, the House version of this bill is not good for New York State. It's not good for California. There are a whole host of places it's not good for. Yet, these Republicans are voting against the interests of their constituents.
Can we talk about our Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin for a moment? Because
signed a dollar bill.
That's a picture, isn't it? Did you
with
see
his
that?
Actress wife.
Pictures worth a thousand.
So Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin met with lawmakers, said the bill would make business cuts permanent because companies need long-term assurances of their tax rates for planning purposes. He also shrugged off concerns that the public would balk at a bill that would provide only temporary tax cuts to individuals. Mnuchin, echoing other Republicans, predicted the individual tax cuts would eventually be extended or made permanent. I do not think it's an optics issue, Mnuchin said. I think people understand that we'll fix the personal side. Do people understand that?
No.
I don't think people have that level of confidence. I mean, there's a lot of questions about, sort of his emphasis seems to be on corporate tax cuts, he was highlighting Apple and their hundreds of billions of dollars in foreign accounts that would possibly in part come back to the United States.
Didn't happen the last time.
He seems to be focused on that. I think the individual taxpayer question doesn't even occur to him in terms of his decision making.
What's the economics of that? I mean, the reason it's not in there now is because the numbers don't work, right? And what will that mean for a place like New York?
That's what it's about. But when you think of the logic of it, we want to make sure that the corporations, for planning purposes, know that they're good forever. But you individuals out there, you fools, you don't have to plan. What?
And he said that out loud. Corporations have to plan.
Right. That's the whole point. Your kids, you don't have to worry about college for your kids and what you're going to do, and you have to mortgage the house and you have to do all of this. So it's inane.
There's a group called Responsible Wealth. I've talked about them before because I'm friends with the person who leads the group and have helped out a little bit. They have organized over 400 millionaires and billionaires to sign a letter saying that this Republican tax approach is not economically sound. It's not in their best interest. They've essentially said, don't raise our taxes. And the philosophy of this group is that these investments are important for them. Investments in the workforce, investments in education, investments in healthcare are what help undergird their business. And exploding the deficits and ending these kinds of investments are worse for them than some of these corporate tax rates would benefit them. And these are people like the former head of American Airlines, Roger Crandall, a couple of the Rockefellers and Disneys. These are leading names who've said this is just not in our interest.
Yeah, you know, let's assume for a second, let's play a game. Let's assume that the tax bill goes down, which I think it will.
I'm not there yet.
Okay.
But I hope it will, but I don't.
Well, now you have guys like Johnson and you're going to have Collins and you're going to have, you know, I mean, it's not going to go. in my opinion. Now, maybe I'm wrong. The president's so alarmed that he got right on the phone with Johnson, Senator Johnson, right. yesterday, and you know, and obviously that could have been. I once heard from Mario Cuomo when we had a disagreement. Somebody told me that conversation didn't go well. That it didn't go well. So, yes. But I think if they look, there's certainly as smart as we are and smarter. Now, they've got to see the handwriting on the wall. This is the game. So why are they doing it? Joe's shaking his head.
No. I'm doing something else. I'm just.
Story.
We'll get into that later.
It's
go
crazy.
Ahead,
okay. Yeah. So what is it? There's an old saying in politics: we'd rather have the issue than the win. So they say, well, we tried, and those bad people didn't let us do it. They've done that with the Democrats all along.
So does McConnell put at health care as a poison pill to? Because he knew he had to slow it down because it's not good for the economy?
Damned if I know.
I don't think so.
Obviously, he's trying to negotiate something in that conference of his, and they're all over the place, and he thinks that, you know, that was the only way he was going to get something.
Because apparently Senator Cotton from Arkansas went to Trump and his people, recommended this, and then they pressured McConnell to put it in.
Which may be because Trump is still stung from his defeat on Obamacare.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many other issues to discuss, and we will do just that. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Little Roxanne this morning, Vitamin Swing helping us out, Swinging to Sting, and the police bringing us in and out of our breaks this morning. We have some letters, and then we'll move on to other stories. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, go ahead.
Okay. John Faso's sudden epiphany on the tax bill, laughing out loud. Panel, after exactly two weeks, John Faso's sudden epiphany in rejecting the Republican tax bill means only one thing to me, that the House leadership has found enough votes without him and has granted him permission to vote against it. In other words, he's off the hook.
Obviously.
It sure didn't take the rest of us New Yorkers that long to realize it was a bad deal. Disgusting, and that's from Jim in Montgomery.
I think that you're exactly right, Jim. You got a pass on this one.
Those of us who have studied the legislative process for years and years know that they do keep these lists, and they say to some people, for example, I don't think Tenney is off the hook yet.
Because they probably think she's not as endangered as he is.
That's right.
That's my guess.
I'm sure you're right.
When I listen to her talk, they probably assume she's not as endangered as he is, and they need her vote.
So as they say, you're in the tank, Claudia. You're not. You are not off
you
the hook.
You don't get a pass.
Yeah. Okay. Yet. And then Dan says, Ron Johnson supported the repeal of Obamacare. Sorry, Joe, he's not a moderate. Now, in Joe's defense, and that's from Dan, who writes us a good deal critically.
I may have misspoken. I was talking about the moderate being Susan Collins, the conservative.
I don't think you did misspeak. I think moderate is a relative term.
Relative to Steve Bannon, he's moderate.
Yes. So, yes, exactly.
In your defense, Joe.
Thank you. I like you all defending me.
Has dramatically shifted.
But it is true that ideologically it's not pinpointed when you say moderate. It sort of shifts with where the party goes.
Well,
right?
Yes. You know. And by the way, one of the ways you could analyze that, although I'll get mail on this, one of the ways you can analyze this, that is whether or not the people on the far right of the party think he's a moderate or not when he does something like this. And believe me,
they probably consider him a left winger.
Exactly.
All right. Let's go to we've wanted to talk about this for a while, and so let's do it now and talk a little bit about what is happening in Yemen. This is just a tragic story, and what is happening as of the United Nations and more than 28 groups said that the Saudi-led coalition's tightening of the blockade on war-torn Yemen could bring millions of people closer to starvation and death. The UN's humanitarian chief warned a day earlier that unless the coalition lifts its blockade, Yemen will face the largest famine the world has seen for many decades, with millions of victims. The coalition closed all ports, halted aid shipments after Yemen's rebels fired a ballistic missile over the weekend that was intercepted near Riyadh. Saudi Arabia blamed the strike on Iran, which supports the Houthis. But has also denied arming them. So,
well, I mean, there's so much to discuss in the Middle East right now because we have this proxy war going on in Yemen where the Iranians and the Saudis are really encountering each other on the ground through proxy forces, and the population is being devastated in terms of humanitarian crisis level situations, lack of access to drinking water, health care, the constant bombing, raids. I mean, it is truly horrific. At the same time, we have to see what's happening in Lebanon, which is the second front in this proxy war, because obviously the Saudis are saying, well, the Iranians are threatening to take over Lebanon. The Saudis encouraged the prime minister of Lebanon, Hariri, to resign. He temporarily went to Saudi, then he returned and now says he didn't really mean to resign. So there is the second potential front that's opening in Lebanon, and we need to see where it all goes. But the clear divisions between Saudi-allied countries and Iran-allied forces is what is emerging. The questions are, what is happening inside Saudi Arabia? We have Mohammed bin Salman continuing to consolidate his power structure. He is redirecting criticism towards Yemen and Lebanon. He's clearly now, we know, we have accounts that some of the princes that have been arrested are being tortured. They had to bring in a medical assistance to some of the princes. He has, bin Salman has been taking enormous amounts of money away from the princes to resupply the state's accounts. One should be really concerned about what's going on. The Saudis are consolidating power.
I have to say that Teresa has helped me a lot on this in getting some articles to read and to inform me on the situation. But there was a link that you sent me from the PBS NewsHour on this. And this goes back to the end of September, where they were saying the biggest challenge is getting people is getting the world to pay attention to this,
right.
Which continues to be the issue. Right.
That's right.
I mean, as it's deterioration, it's like, oh, by the way, this is happening. And it's horrible.
Right. I think this is such a critical issue, and I know I've tried to bring it up, but it's been going on since 2015, but it's really stepped up over the last couple of months. And the U.S. under President Trump are now complicit in this. We are, among other things, the U.S. military is refueling planes, the Saudi planes that are going and dropping bombs on schools and hospitals and transportation and other facilities. In fact, it's gotten to such a point that the House of Representatives on Monday, thank goodness, finally debated this. They passed it 366-30, a resolution saying that the U.S. Should not be involved in this war. This is a civil war, not a civil war, but this is a war that the Americans should directing the War Powers Resolution to remove the United States Armed Forces from unauthorized hostilities in the Republic of Yemen. Bipartisan. So
it's basically saying they can fight ISIS, they can fight Al-Qaeda, they can fight the Houthis.
They can't fight the Houthis. Side with Saudis, right, and the Houthis. And so what's the practicality of this on the ground? What the Saudis have done is, for months now, they've been blocking a key port where fishermen go out to catch fish and get food, where food comes in. So they've been blocking food from coming in. Over the last couple of weeks, there's a nationwide blockade. You can't get aid workers in there. They're using food and medicine as a tool of war. There's a cholera outbreak. There are more than two-thirds of the people don't have access to food. They are starving people to death, and we're sitting by, and no one's paying attention. This is genocide. And you have to say, during the Nazi situation, people say, well, why didn't people do more? Well, they are killing people
I just want to give some numbers here, just to put this into some context. So far, the conflict has claimed more than 13,500 lives, 900,000 suffering from cholera, roughly 20 million Yemenis need humanitarian assistance to meet their basic needs.
Out of
like
population,
food and water.
27 million population, out of a 20 million at risk.
Sorry. 28 million.
Yeah. I'm sorry, yeah, Vera. Just one question to both of our experts here, and that is, what is our fascination and our allegiance to Saudi Arabia here? Why is that so important?
That seems like a huge topic. So let me take a break. We'll go, and then when we come back, we'll talk about that, because it is, and of course, what is happening now in Saudi Arabia with the 32-year-old crown prince of what is happening there. So let's take a break. We'll pause that.
And let's remember who the 9/11 bombers were.
More than half the people, no access to clean water.
All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Rob, every little thing you do is magic.
Yeah.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program, and it is a delight to have you all with us. Teresa Bourgeois is here, Vera Akarios-Kelly, and Alan Chartok. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, and that is where you can send your letters to us. We just have one. Let's do the one letter that you have there, Alan, and then we'll. This is on the tax plan, and then we'll get back to the question you asked before we went to break about our interests in Saudi Arabia.
Right. John says, tax bill. The congressional Republicans have abandoned any pretext of normal order in order to engage in unbridled flim-flammery on this tax bill. They're selling us snake oil. Nothing more, nothing less. It will be up to the voters to send these flim-flamming charlatans packing in 2018.
I'm a huge fan of flim-flammery
as
a word, yes.
And that's John from Saratoga Springs.
So all I can say on the issue of snake oil, that is also how that works in Saudi Arabia, because snake oil is what's needed to keep that state together. Namely, it's a rentier state where the elite uses all of its oil resources to redistribute to key allies. So the glue that has kept the state together was the Wahhabi clerics, because that's the justification for its existence. And then the money from the oil industry is used to basically keep the population loyal. So there are certain payments that are made annually, right, to keep people engaged with the state and silent in terms of policy issues. Well, but here's the issue now. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the same kind of money anymore. They have spent hundreds of billions of dollars on this war in Yemen and to redirect sort of, you know, Qatar, and you know, so bin Salman is looking at the outside world and saying, well, I need to redirect the population so I can modernize, consolidate power, and push this modernization agenda 2030 forward in the country. So he has arrested hundreds of clerics several months ago. He went out after hundreds of clerics, so because they were going to be opposed to the issue of women being allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia. So he needed to quiet them. And then he, of course, needs to replenish the state's accounts because he's spent enormous amounts of money on this war in Yemen. So he goes after you know, other princes that are exceptionally wealthy, takes the money and uses that to consolidate his power and pay off intelligence services and key people within his family. So here's the problem at hand. The United States is finally waking up to the issue that we have a huge potential problem in Saudi Arabia. What will happen if Saudi Arabia runs out of money in a few years, the oil prices don't go up to the way they used to be, and we have a buckling of the oil industry? And at the same time, the Saudi prince is trying to engage in proxy wars. Well, who will fight the proxy wars but the United States? Will have to invest enormous amounts of resources into this effort to stabilize Saudi Arabia. If there is a war or any hostility between the Iranians and the Saudis, it is not the Iranians who will be fighting this war, but it will be based on U.S. support and U.S. resources. We have a huge potential problem that we will face in the coming years. we have genocide and killings at a mass level, as Teresa said, in Yemen. We have the emerging
blockade in Qatar.
We have the emerging Shiite Sunni issue in Lebanon again, which might engage, you know, which might create an internal civil war like conditions again. So this is all bad for
and then
the
you
United
have Israeli
States.
Interests mixed into all of this, destabilizing the Middle East, and not Israeli interests disabling
yes.
Middle East,
uh-huh.
but it all adds into
yeah.
that. But the other factor you have, and Alan, you may want to speak to this, is the Trump businesses' personal interests in Saudi Arabia. They have businesses in Saudi Arabia, but the also is the Sovereign Wealth Fund. The Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund has investments in the U.S., including, I believe, some investments in the Trump businesses. But so, you know, there are a lot of threads to this, this situation. In the meantime, you have 20 million plus people in Yemen suffering as a result of this, who are innocent civilians. And it's tragic, and it's part of it is being done with our taxpayer dollars. We're complicit in this.
Yep, and it's depressing to see that we're not paying enough attention to it. Maybe this will be changing now that we have this initiative
in Congress. Really a shout-out to Congressman Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, who, along with a congressman from California, have really been leading the effort to try to draw attention to this issue.
He's a regular. I should just point out on our Congressional Corner program, we love having him there.
Mm. And you mentioned, we were talking during the break about the other troublesome spot in the world.
Well, when you look at what's going on in Burma and the Muslim minority there in terms of the Rohingya minority. Now, if there's any doubt in anyone's mind, we have a genocide ongoing at this very moment that we're not paying very close attention to. As a matter of fact, Tillerson was in the region trying his very best not to call it a genocide, so that there wouldn't have to be some actual response to this horrific treatment of this minority,
driving millions of people out of the country, right
across the border into Bangladesh, which is a deeply impoverished country itself. So this is a truly gruesome moment in history. It's deeply distressing because at a time where we are talking about the ideology of ISIS, moving throughout the world, reverberating, we're creating new places in the world where radicals can actually appeal to young men that have been so profoundly traumatized and undergone horrific, unjust treatments in Yemen and in Myanmar or Burma. Which is the kinds of places that we should be paying attention to immediately as a country that leads in terms of global justice and the as a beacon of freedom. But we pay no attention to human rights questions, except for now Congress, thankfully, is at least paying attention to Yemen since yesterday.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to other topics. And I do want to get to the Asia trip and talk about the reaction to that. The president yesterday returned and held it wasn't a press conference, but he went out, he spoke, and said that his Asia trip, forged new unity against North Korea. They have a new resolve to confronting North Korea and its rogue nuclear weapons program, claiming credit Wednesday for projecting a stronger and more confident United States, unafraid to insist on sovereignty and respect. He said time is running out on dealing with North Korea. With China, North Korea's most important ally, Trump said he reaffirmed that all options are on the table.
Well, now, it's interesting, Joe, because the Chinese did send a major ambassador potentate to North Korea recently. And I think, I'm sure I'll be corrected by everybody if I'm wrong, he hasn't set off a missile for a while. So he wants credit for that. The president wants credit for having done that. But I think credit is at the top of this White House thing, because what happened is he got out, and I'm sure the White House had something to do with it, but everywhere he went, there were these marching bands and goose steppers and everybody else who were welcoming him. And he said, well, isn't this terrific? This is what I'd like in the United States. I can't have it. But look, I have this all over the place. They look at the U.S. press and there's nothing. You know, they may take a picture or two of it, but nobody really cares that they've put these people out on the street waving flags and doing the goose step, doing these other things. So he now comes back to the United States and says, I want to report to you about the amount of respect which we were treated with abroad. And nobody seems to buy it. Nobody seems to care.
No. I mean, obviously, in Asia, what Trump enjoyed was the pomp and circumstance, standing side by side with dictators and horrific human rights violators without mentioning the notion of human rights or civil liberties in any form. And then he reports back to the American public how deeply respected the United States is. He has no actual results from this trip except that he had lots of photo ops.
Well, we don't know, really.
Well, we'll see.
We don't know about the relationship with the Chinese. To me, that is crucial. We do know that he mentioned, quote, mentioned, they're all saying, he mentioned to Duterte the civil rights, that it was mentioned in his conversation with him. That may be true, may not be, we'll never know. And we don't know how important it was.
He said America is back. He claimed progress against the Islamic State and other accomplishments, but did not go into detail about his approach to difficult foreign policy problems such as the ongoing war in Syria, the spread of Iranian influence or Russian territorial and other ambitions. He did not mention his decision last month to withdraw the presidential endorsement for the international nuclear deal with Iran or his planned withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. Both decisions have put U.S. allies on edge and led some to question America's commitments overseas. He also made no mention of Russian President Vladimir Putin, with whom he met on the margins of a regional conference in Vietnam. Teresa.
Right. He gave himself an A. I think
the self-grading is cool.
Yeah.
It would make my life a lot easier. I think I'm going to try and introduce that in my courses.
Yeah, bring that up at Siena. See how they like
it. I will run it by my classes and report back.
As a communications person, the speech was so, the talk was, he was clearly reading it, and it was so poorly written. He just needs to get a better writer. That's an aside. But I just thought that clearly these countries understand how to play to him with all the pomp and circumstance. You saw the Saudis do it, you saw the Chinese do it, you saw the others do it, you see how he reacts to it. But on the policy side, which is what really matters, he just seems not informed and weak. And clearly the Chinese are much, much stronger. You think about the Paris Accords on climate, or you think about various trade deals that he's walked away from. I was thinking about this in the context of the Alabama race and what does a tax bill and what does this foreign trip mean for people in Alabama? Because, you know, they're on his side. And some of the key businesses, they're in the running for a $1.6 billion Toyota Mazda manufacturing plant. Well, what is his getting out of the Asia trade deal going to mean for that, if anything? Does that give it a bet? Less chance. One of the key employers where they have new investments is Bombardier. They're a Canadian company. What does the changes in NAFTA do to that relationship? Another one is something called Nemak, which is a Mexican auto parts manufacturer. So in the United States, what are going to be the impact of him walking away from NAFTA, walking away from the table in the climate agreement, walking away from the table in all of these various coalition efforts at trade? Because we do live and work in a global economy that's interconnected.
So, Teresa, isn't it possible that what's really going on here is like other people who like to see, we've talked about how he admires the dictators and the other guys. When you walk away from an NAFTA, when you walk away from those agreements, and you basically say, we want to deal with people on a one-to-one basis all the time, that gives him inordinate power, and I think that's what he's after.
But does it really give him power, or does it give an opening for the Chinese to come in? Because it is a globally, it's a globally interconnected supply chain.
No, you're right. You're right.
And so he says
right.
that gives me better one-on-one bargaining power. But for instance, in the the European community, you can't negotiate with those country by country. And so what it's done is strengthen China's hand at the table.
Well, as an intellectual,
it strengthened. I'm sorry.
But as an intellectual, it's only because we're running out of time. As an intellectual, you're exactly right. But I don't think that is what Trump is all about. I think Trump is messaging to the base. We've talked about that 1,000 times. Trump is talking and keeping it very simple and saying to people, all right, we don't want to be trapped in something in which we're losers. We want to be winners. That appeals to people.
But you can be simple but wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know that he understands the complexity of these interrelationships.
I don't think
he
cares. He
doesn't appear to at all. Yeah. And he hasn't surrounded himself with people who do know. And so it's just like the Republicans repeal and replace, repeal and replace, repeal and replace health care. But when it got down to the details, and that's what really affects people's lives is the details,
true.
It didn't work. When it gets down to the details of this tax plan, the numbers don't get
up. I agree with that.
Up. When it gets down to the details of these investments in Alabama, that if you take away these agreements and have a free-for-all and they're not at the table, are they going to get that Toyota Mazda plant? What is going to happen with them as a major part supplier in the global supply chain for car manufacturers?
Yeah.
What does that mean for the people in Alabama?
Yeah, well, but there's a long-term, I'm sorry, Vera, but there's a long-term depth of knowledge that Teresa has that the guy on the street might not have, or the woman on the street might not have.
So I just wanted to say on the sort of the transactional leadership, the sort of inability to understand the complexity of China rising, and China really clearly sees itself as the global power emerging because the United States is removing itself from, you know, international global trade agreements, which now China will lead in terms of the TPP and other.
Or even in Zimbabwe. You know, they're going to come in Zimbabwe and be the force there.
Or so even in the U.S.
In the U.S.
At the same time, look at what's happening in a parallel hierarchical structure of the State Department, where Tillerson is taking apart the State Department, shrinking it down. People with dozens of years of expertise, diplomats that speak multiple languages, have lots of expertise, are departing the State Department. Young people are not hired in. We have a lack of language ability. And the consequences this country will suffer for the next decade or two because of both Trump's hierarchical leadership and now Tillerson in the State Department are unbelievably devastating, and we will see it in our economy.
I'd like to just shift for a moment because something really annoyed me in the news last night, and that was Ivanka Trump saying, in contradistinction, I suspect, from what we think of the president, that there's a special place in hell for anybody who messes with kids. Something I think we can all agree with. Nevertheless, it's interesting that Trump hasn't said that.
In the context of the Alabama race.
Yes, the Alabama race. But it's interesting that Trump hasn't said that.
Right.
Now, those of you who believe, all hold up your hands, that Ivanka did not check in with the president before she said something like this. I think it's a strategy, and the strategy is I can't say anything because I got all these accusers myself. But you can, Ivanka, and then there'll be a sort of a Trump-like effect on this.
Well, of course, the accusers, to our knowledge, not accusing of preying on children, so there is the difference there. But as far as
She was a child, wasn't she, when this main accuser was approached by Moore?
Trump is not being accused.
Oh, no, that's right.
Ivanka goes out and talks about there's a special place in hell for pedophiles.
Right, for people who prey on children.
Yes.
So, but the question that Alan asked, which is, so why can't the president say that?
Well, because he has people who are coming at him. They may not be accused pedophiles, but they are accused gropers, and we know that. And so, therefore, if he starts saying more was wrong with this than some, the next person comes along and says, look at all these women who are saying things about you.
So, well, we're out of time, but so we'll pause there, but we'll continue as we should know that more women have come forward on the, yep, in the Roy Moore case. So.
And I actually have trust in Alabama voters. I think they are paying close attention, they are no fools, and they will decide on their own what is best.
From your mouth to God's ear.
And if you're upset about it, just go to Doug Jones's website. And
all right. There's your homework. We'll be back after this.